take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Late Date will be live at 11 here on RTE Radio 1. Kyle has suitable songs to steer us out of Monday into Tuesday. First, though, the natural world is the natural habitat for Mooney Goes Wild.
Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. As always, we have a cracking show lined up for you tonight. 55 minutes of pure indulgence in the natural world. Where would you get it? Only right here on RTE Radio 1. In studio with me, Aina Neelan and Niall Hatch. From his home in Malahide, Dr. Richard Collins. Terry Flanagan will be joining us shortly to tell us all about a farmer who's very interested in biodiversity and has constructed a sand martin bank, a place for sand martins to nest. Fascinating stuff. We'll hear all about that very shortly. But I want to go back to last week's programme. When I suggested, Aina, you didn't strike me as a shrinking violet. And you said just before we come on air, hey, I have something to say about that. So what is it, Aina? Are you a shrinking violet?
Well, I would never have been described as a shrinking violet before in my life. I've been described as lots of things, but never that. And I don't know what English poets had against the poor unfortunate violet, because this term comes from these English poets that went around the time, late 1700s, fellas like Keats and Shelley and Wordsworth. And you had Wordsworth sort of describing some friend of his, a violet by a mossy stone, half hidden from the eye, fair as the star when only one is shining in the sky. In other words, the violet is only noticeable when it's there on its own. And it was a friend of Shelley's, a fella called Leigh Hunt, who said, there was the buttercup, struggling from a white to a dirty yellow, and a faintly coloured poppy, and here and there by the thorny undergrowth, a shrinking violet. So they were the ones that would go around calling flowers names. I mean, if you want to actually get botanical descriptions, do not go to English poets who are just wanting big words. I mean, the wood violet is gorgeous, that lovely purple colour in the
head. They're very vibrant, aren't they, violets?
So yeah. A violet by a mossy stone, half hidden from the eye, fair as a star, when only one is shining in the sky. So, shrinking violet. I certainly am not a shrinking violet, and neither is the violet. Boycott that term. Nobody is a shrinking violet anymore.
I remember from my childhood, there used to be a lot more violet-flavoured things than there are today. There used to be these violet-flavoured sweets with Parma violets. I'm sure you can still get them.
Queen Elizabeth's mother used to have those. They were her favourite ones.
I haven't thought about them in years. It's such a distinctive kind of smell from my childhood, being like at my grandmother's house, this violet smell that you just don't get anymore.
What does it
really
smell like?
It's
violet.
I don't know, it's chicken, floral and quite pleasant. It's not like a rose or anything like that. It's honestly quite pleasant, but the kind of thing that if you smell it too much, you eat too many of those sweets, it gets really sickening very quickly. It used to be quite a well-used food flavouring, and it doesn't seem to be anymore.
Richard, are you a shrinking violet?
I actually am, Derek. I like to take a back seat and let everybody else do all the things and then send the torpedo into what they said. You know, I'm a terrible malicious person, but that's me.
But I mean, is it an appropriate term, a shrinking violet?
Not at all. Poets are not good guides to what is real about the world. They are fantasists, basically. Nothing wrong with that. We need our fantasies. As Eliot said, was it, mankind cannot bear that much reality. So we have to dress it up in fantasy and so forth. And the violet is ideal. It's such a beautiful flower and present. You see it all the time in season.
Just checking here, Richard. Well remembered. The actual quote is, humankind cannot bear very much reality. But if anybody has seen the movie A Few Good Men, think of Jack Nicholson screaming at Tom Cruise, you can't handle the truth. I wonder, was he paraphrasing Eliot? Anyway, we're joined in studio now by Terence Flanagan. Terry has been looking at sand martins in the land of the lily whites. Terry!
Well, yes, I was down in North County Kildare. I met up with Dermot Dorn. Dermot Dorn is a farmer down there, and he's very interested in biodiversity. And he recently built a wildlife pond. And when the pond attracted lots and lots of insects, guess what came next? Sand martins. So he decided then to build a sand martin wall. So I visited him recently to see how he was getting on.
Now, Terry, just mind your step here, coming down these steps. It's right close to the pond. That's not a pond, that's a lake. It's absolutely huge and it's got two islands on it, and I'm looking at dragonflies flying over it. There's a heron up above. But what I've come to see are these birds that are flying around the sky here. And I must see 30 or so of them. They're sand martins. And also in front of me, I see this. You tell me it's a wall. To me, it's like a shed. A sand martin wall. How did the sand martin wall come about?
Well, Terry, back in early 2017, in an effort to increase the farmland biodiversity, I decided to dig a pond. And soon after the pond was dug, lots of new species started showing up. The likes of moorhen, coot and little grebe showed up straight away. Also the likes of mallard and teal. And during the first summer, I noticed lots of dragonflies and damselflies about. But what really caught my attention was lots of sand martin feeding low over the water. I knew that they were in decline and they were an amber listed bird of conservation concern. So I saw them a lot over the summer of 2018, and I put a bit of thought into it and I said to myself, no, I can do something for these. So I knew that sand martin readily take to man-made structures. And I knew also that sand martin walls were in existence. It's not new thinking. So I started doing my research in the fall of 2018 and came up with a plan and a design and decided then to build a wall myself.
Now the wall is just right here behind us and we can hear the birds flying by. We can actually see them overhead. But it's not a wall. It's a shed, is it?
Yeah, it's more or less, there's four sides to it, and there's sand martin tunnels on three sides, and you can walk into it to assess and to monitor the nests from inside.
Looking at it here from the outside, there must be about 100 tunnels, is there?
No, actually, Terry, there's more. There's 140, so there is.
Wow.
Yeah.
And each of those will lead to a nest?
Correct.
Tell me a bit about the tunnel. How long is it, or how is it composed? What's it composed of?
The wall was built basically with cavity blocks, and the tunnel is about 9 inches long, and the cavity then is about 6 inches inside.
For the nest?
For the nest, yes.
Okay. And they line this nest, I think, with feathers and the likes?
To do, yeah, to bring in pieces of nesting material, dried grass first, and then they line it with feathers. Mm-hmm. A lot of the feathers are actually mallard feathers.
Right. I believe they sometimes play feather games when the feathers are floating in the air, that they will chase these feathers. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah. It's amazing to watch them now.
So when did they arrive here in Ireland?
They arrive mid-March.
So you're down here from what, the start of March, watching every day to see them?
Yes, I am. This year now, they arrived, the first time I saw them was the 18th of March.
Right. And do they start nesting then, or do they hang around for a few days feeding up, or what?
No, they don't start nesting straight away. I find that they can really delay their nesting depending on the weather. But this year now, the weather was poor, and they didn't start nesting with me until about the first week of June, which was really late.
Right.
But on a normal year, they could be nesting maybe the second or third week of April. They'll start nesting seriously then.
Of these 140 tunnels that you have leading to 140 possible nests, how many are occupied?
It's hard to have an accurate count, but there's somewhere between 35 and 40 occupied nests here at the minute.
How does that compare with previous years?
Well, it's slightly down on last year now. I had just slightly over 40 nests last year. Mm. But I started off in 2019 when the nested first, there was only two pairs. But they quickly moved from two pairs to, you know, 40 pairs in the space of a few years.
That's excellent. So you're producing lots and lots of young birds that are hopefully going back to Africa.
Yeah, I calculate now since 2019 to the end of this breeding season this year in 2024, there'll be almost 1,000 chicks fledged.
Are they ringed?
We ringed a few of them. A friend of mine, Declan Manley, he rings birds.
A good friend of the programme?
Yeah, so he ringed a few last year. But through time constraints on Declan, we didn't get a chance to ring them in any meaningful way.
What about this year? Do you hope then to ring more of them?
I'm not too sure. It'll all depend on Declan's timetable. He's a busy man.
So there's between 35 and 40 nests occupied. Is it young that's in them at the moment?
It varies. There's some eggs, there are some chicks ready to fledge, and then there's some chicks that are only after hatching. It's now high summer and it's a beautiful day today, very, very mild, very, very calm. Tell us exactly what the birds are doing here on the pond.
Well, at the minute, it depends at what stage their nest is, really. What we're seeing here is maybe 25 birds over our heads, and they're hawking for insects, basically. I'd say the vast majority of them would have chicks inside that need to be fed. Mm-hmm. So they spend their whole day, really, looking for insects.
Now, the wall is facing outwards onto the pond, and the holes or the openings to the nests are facing onto the pond, so it makes it very easy for them to gain access.
Yeah, sand martin have a tendency to feed over water. That's why a lot of sand martin walls are located just over the water, because they can catch the sand martin's attention and they have easy access to a good feeding area over water. So it's a good idea to locate one at water where they have a good clear flight path underneath the tunnel.
What insects are they feeding on? I suppose it's the small gnats and flies, is it?
Yeah, I'd imagine it varies. It'd be small enough. Now, these birds are tiny.
Yeah, they are.
So I'd say they're small.
They're smaller than swallows, these birds.
Yeah, they're absolutely tiny. They're smaller than house martins. They're the smallest member of the swallow family.
They're very dull in colour too, aren't they?
Yeah, lovely brown. Mm. And they're brown and then kind of a whitish colour underneath.
Mm. I know in North America they're sometimes referred to as bank swallows because they look like swallows and they nest in banks, and you've got a bank here, except it's an artificial one.
Correct, yeah.
Tell me about the actual wall itself, the construction of it. It must have been a big job and an expensive job.
Yeah, well, towards the end of 2018, I started Googling and decided then I would build the wall. And I enlisted the services of a couple of my friends, Anthony Mooney, who lives close by, and Fergal O'Quinnigan. And they gave me a hand doing the actual construction.
Was it difficult?
Well, it was. The weather was atrocious. But once we had the foundation dug and poured, laying the blocks then was quite difficult. But as you can see today now, it really was worth it.
That first year that the birds came, you said there were only two nests occupied. It still must have been a great thrill for you.
Yeah, it was actually unbelievable. To be honest with you, when I built the wall, there was no guarantees that the birds would actually use it. And a fair few bob was spent creating the wall, and with no guarantees, like, you know, it really was amazing to see it occupied and going from strength to strength then every year.
Well, I suppose if you're thinking of putting in a wall, you really need to have a pond, and I'm sure you need to have sand martins present before you go to that expense.
Yes, the recommendations are not to build a wall unless the birds are feeding in the area overhead or they're nesting close by, because there's a lot of expense with zero guarantees. So the guidelines are that they need to be feeding in the area.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a camera in any of the nest boxes?
I do, I have.
And you can watch that from the house?
Well, Terry, with technology these days, I don't have to go to the house. I can watch it on my phone.
Great. You must get some great video from it.
I really do. I've some fantastic footage of chicks only a day old. It's yeah, amazing to see it.
And then as they fledge, do they hang around for a while?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not too sure whether the chicks leave or not, because they're actually too small. I don't think a tracker or a geolocator was ever put on one, so I honestly don't know whether they hang about or...
Do you see them around the pond here flying around? Can you tell the adults from the young?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, they're slightly a paler colour. And you can see them for a couple of weeks, but after that, then, you know, you'd want to be paying real close attention now to differentiate between them.
How many clutches then would they have in a summer?
Well, I've recorded them having three clutches. I've had sand martins here up till the middle of September.
Oh, that's really good. That's really good. And then that day comes when you come down here, you stand beside your wall, and it's silent.
Yeah, it's really sad to see them go. You know, I'd be counting the days for them to come back in March, and it makes for a long winter.
But it's well worth the wait.
Yeah, it really is, because the satisfaction you get seeing them mid to late March is absolutely unreal, and the wall was worth all the effort.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Terry. Sounds very interesting. Richard, you want to say something?
On San Martins, yes. San Martins are wonderful birds. It's interesting about the swallows. They're a swallow family. Martins, house martin, San Martin, and the barn swallow. They have all sold out and they all go into human habitation. For instance, the swallow goes into the barn. The house martin goes in under the eaves. And not to be outdone, there has sand martin loves quarries and places we have excavated where it can have burrows and get in there. So it's a very interesting little bird from that point of view. Now, back in 1968, there was a sand martin inquiry, I think, in Britain and Ireland, and there was 10,000 reports of sand martins, and in those years, 400,000 sand martins were ringed. Now, one of the curious things that came in was that fly fishermen reported sand martins, not sand martins they had seen, but sand martins they had caught with their rods. The sand martins would scoop down and pick up a fly, and sometimes it would pick up a fly that wasn't a real fly, it was the fly fisherman's fly, and would be hauled in. And there were also a few records of sand martins hit by golf balls, believe it or not. And there was one report, I think, if my memory serves me right, eaten by a pike as it came down to grab an insect from the water. The pike came up and clobbered it. It's a very interesting, fascinating little bird. Comes all the way from southern Africa, across the Sahara, across the Mediterranean, up through Europe. This year, I am very disappointed. I have a lovely colony about 100 metres from me normally. Deserted this year. They never showed up at all. I've seen a few pottering around, but they have not bred there this year. I hope they come back.
It's a very successful species in global terms. It's very, very widespread, has a wide range, much more so than, let's say, the house martin, which is a bird it would often be confused with here in Ireland. It's found in North America, for example, as well. And I'm sure our North American listeners, of whom I know we have quite a few online, they'll know the bird by a different name. In North America, it's the bank swallow. Exactly the same species, the sand martin, the bank swallow. You can use the names interchangeably. But it does give a good description, I suppose, of how they live. They do excavate these tunnels in sandbanks and riverbanks, soft cliffs. I've seen them in parts of South County Dublin. You see them there in these soft cliffs by the sea. And it's a bird that's very, I suppose, very vulnerable to things like coastal erosion. We're seeing now a lot of these nesting cliffs where they would traditionally be actually falling down, collapsing, crumbling, even when, unfortunately, the eggs or the chicks are inside them during the summer, especially during summer storms. So these artificial banks and nesting facilities can actually make a big difference for this bird. And it's a bird, I think, that deserves to be better known. I think, you know, a lot of people in Ireland will have seen this species without really realising it. You can see these hirundines, the swallows and martins, flying around, particularly this time of year as they're getting ready to go on their migration. Nesting is just finishing and they're hoovering up all these insects before they head off. And all three species can occur together. You see them quite readily together, but people often don't stop and look and realise they're actually looking at three different species in the same flock. So people should keep an eye out for them a bit more, I think.
So they actually make their own holes. They can burrow. Yeah. I mean, the little birds, how do they? I mean, they've hardly any beaks. They've gapes for eating insects. So how do they excavate a tunnel?
I've seen them do it. It's mostly with their feet. So what they do is they find a sort of a natural little maybe crevice or a little crack maybe in the face of the cliff or in the substrate or whatever, and then they seem to work in with their beak first of all, but then when they can get their claws into it, they just sort of frantically dig and kick the sand or the earth back out and dig a tunnel that way. Kingfishers do a similar thing, and actually you mentioned about quarries. In continental Europe there's another species that often nests side by side with the sand martins. That's the bee eater, which does the same thing. It's a really, really colourful bird. Almost looks like a child's fantasy drawing of a bird. It's so intensely colourful. And they do eat bees, and that's where the name comes from. But what we're seeing now is they've actually started to breed now in southern England. It's thought because of climate change.
The bee eaters have.
So the sand martins have been here as long as we have. We've known them for a long time. But the fact is, these bee eaters are now nesting alongside sand martins in similar sort of habitats in southern England. Climate change, most likely, almost certainly indeed, has driven that. It would be interesting to see, if given enough time, if that then becomes the case in Ireland as well. We know that bee eaters, it's a very rare vagrant to Ireland. They have occurred. They've never nested here, never even shown a sign of it. But it'd be worth checking in some of those sand martin colonies just to see if bee eaters do actually take.
Well, mind you, if you saw a bee eater, you'd definitely give up eating the blue Smarties if it was flying in and out of a hole. Do they make them fairly deep, these holes? And is there any problem with rats? I mean, the way you have with puffins also live in tunnels and they're very vulnerable to being predated by rats. Does the same happen, or is it the fact that it's on a cliff, does that save the sand martins?
In many cases it does. So it's not, they're not completely safe. So yes, I'm no doubt rodents sometimes do get in. I know sometimes stoats can get in too, because they're very agile and they're very good at getting down those kind of chambers, just the right size and shape for it. So no doubt some do succumb to mammalian predators each year. But because we have this, they nest often with this vertical face in front of them, it's very hard for a predator to climb up on. But you do sometimes see birds of prey like sparrowhawks lying in ambush waiting for the adults to come out, because they know that when the bird has gone in with food, it's got to come back out again to get more, and so they can sometimes lie in wait. But I know in the nests, the cavities, the chambers can be quite deep. But one of the issues that sand martins have, and you'll know this well from bird ringing, Richard, one of the problems they have in their nest sites is that members of the swallow family tend to be absolutely infested with parasites. They have all sorts of flat flies and mites and so on. Is that something you've encountered, Richard?
Yes, they are inclined to do that. And they have other problems. For instance, there have been reports of sand martins dying of starvation and hypothermia when there are no insects to feed on. Now, that is interesting for this year because there have been very few. So sometimes the sand martins rather optimistically make burrows and go into them but can't get enough food to survive. Now, how prevalent that is, I don't know. Now, the figures for this, the ringing figures, are interesting. Off the top of my head, I remember this, in a good year there would be about 40,000 ringed in the British and Irish scheme. And in a bad year, that would be down to a tenth of that, around 4,000. So it is now, that doesn't mean they're all dead. They may not have ventured further north. Martin is also, places like Castle Martyr are probably called after martins. So the martins, that is the house sparrow, the house martin and the sand martin and the swallow. That's probably the origin of that name. And you have the word martinet, which is a strict disciplinarian, I think, a martinet. But I don't think that has any obvious connection with our little martins, who are gentle souls.
All right. Anyway, Aina, you're next. Now, why have you got your mobile phone in your hand? What are you doing?
Derek, I want to play you a song. I really do. I'm not going to sing it for you. This is a song by Judy Collins from 1970. A most wonderful song.
Judy Collins as in Send In the Clowns and Both Sides Now, Judy Collins?
That same Judy Collins, but this is a song called Farewell to Tarwathy, and it was the first time that humpback whales are appearing in a record. Now, Roger Payne, in 1967, only that time, discovered for the first time whale song in the humpback whale.
Yeah.
And then he gave the tapes to people to sing, and the only one that took him up on this was Judy Collins in 1970, and she produced this one, Farewell to Tarwathy. It was mega, it went gold, most beautiful song, and she's actually singing a duet with the actual song of the whale as recorded by Roger Payne in 1967. Have a listen.
Farewell to Tarwathy, adieu Mormon and the dear land of Crimond, I bid thee farewell. We're bound off for Greenland and ready to sail in hopes to find riches in hunting the whale.
Now, we've discussed Roger Payne on this programme many times in the past, have we not, Niall Hatch?
We have. He passed away in June of last year after a very long career bringing attention to the plight of whales. He did so much to, I suppose, make the world understand that there was more to these than just large fish. Of course, they're not fish at all, but that's the way people would have thought of them, that they actually had this really complex communication, these beautiful sounds. And it's his recordings from the late 60s that really galvanised and catalysed the whole movement to stop the hunting of whales, which still goes on. Certain countries do still practice that, but by and large, it's a thing of the past in most of the world, and it was because people found the songs of the humpback whale so unbelievably beautiful.
Well, that is a beautiful song, I have to say. And anyway, what's it got to do with today's programme?
There is a book called Sing Like Fish, written by Amarina Kingdon, and it's all about ocean sound in water, underwater, biological sounds made by the tides themselves, earthquakes, sounds made by humans, sounds made by the creatures there. It isn't just the whales that sing. The sound underwater is magnificent. Jack Cousteau in the old days described underwater as a silent world because humans are not fish. It's not our métier to be down there. He could hear nothing because his ears didn't work on the water. And so it was his report that underwater was a quiet place that gave delight to such things. Underwater is anything but a quiet place. And Amarina has written a most wonderful, technical, scientific, well-written book telling us all of the research that has taken place about sound underwater. And I caught up with her during the week from her home in Canada.
Hi, Aina. I'm in Ontario. I'm specifically at Jack's Lake, just near Apsley, Ontario. It is grey. It is windy. I've got a north wind coming right across the bay. I've got probably about 19 degrees Celsius, and that's probably because a large number of storms went through yesterday. So it feels very much like autumn. And it feels very, very much like the seasons are going to start to turn soon, which makes sense because it's August. And I'm looking at probably cloud for the rest of the day, not a little bit of sun. And that's probably what's going to happen for the next little while. So if we want to go swimming, I think the lake's going to start to cool down for the year. So we probably got about a week or so of good swimming left before it's going to become way too cold. And as I'm saying this, I'm looking out my window and a loon has just come up about 10 feet off the end of my dock and is looking around trying to figure out what's going on. It's an absolutely beautiful animal, about a foot long, with a really beautiful sleek black head. And as I'm talking, it dove back down again looking for fish.
Hello, Amarina. It's great to talk to you. I'm really envious of you there looking at your loon. It must be great to see it in its breeding plumage with the black head. We get it here as a visitor in the winter time. We call it a great northern diver, but it's not in its breeding plumage at that time of year.
It's great to talk to you too. Now, where are you sitting?
I'm sitting in Dublin, in my room in Dublin, where it is not half as bad as you make it sound there, although it's probably only about 18 degrees, but we are happy with that for our summer, so we don't mind. And I've been doing lots of swimming in the sea, where it has been a warm 14.5 degrees in the water. So we're not doing too badly here. And I'm absolutely captivated with your book, Sing Like Fish, How Sound Rules Life Under the Water, because I myself did a lot of underwater diving when I could fit into my wetsuit and carry aqualungs on my back. So I'm really interested in this whole world of sound. And Jack Cousteau, as you mentioned in the beginning, released a film in 1956 called The Silent World, showing underwater life filmed using this scuba gear that he helped to invent. And he gave the popular notion to the world that the world underneath the waves were silent. But the world underneath the waves, the world in the oceans, is not silent, is it?
No, it's not at all. In fact, under the water, sound might actually be said to be the sense of choice. Because the water is so much denser than air, sound moves really, really well through it. It moves about 4.5 times faster than it does in air. And it goes a lot further and it degrades less. So if you send a signal, it's going to sound more true to what it was when it gets to its final destination. Whereas underwater as well, light, which we rely on a lot above the waves, it absorbs it very quickly. And so even in the clearest water, once you get down below a couple hundred meters, you can't see anything. And then if you're near the coasts, chances are there's going to be a lot of silt or plankton or murk. So it's very hard to see as well underwater as we do above the water. And then when it comes to chemicals that carry things like scent or taste, they diffuse slower out through the denser water as well. So if you think about it, not only is it that sound works really, really well underwater, but because all the other channels of information, if you will, work less well, it means that if you're in the water and you want to know what's going on around you, you really do have a vested interest in figuring out how to listen.
Indeed, and not only ourselves, not much ourselves, it's the animals underwater that hear sound. Now, we have the mammals, the sea mammals, and they have ears, you know, like mammals have in general. But for fish have ears too, they're quite different ears to the mammals' ones. They even have things in them called otoliths. And these are hearing sounds as well. But some invertebrates and some fish will detect sound
by the movement of particles. So how sound is detected underwater depends on who's listening to it. Could you expand a bit on that for me, Amarina?
Well, essentially, an ear, as I learned, is any organ that's devoted just to perceiving sound. So we humans have ears, whales have ears, and fish have ears. But all those ears have very different shapes and structures. The only thing that makes them ears is that their function is what they're doing, they're listening. But as you said, there's a whole bunch of other animals, more than 90% of the species in the ocean are invertebrates. They don't have ears. They don't have anything that we would call an ear, but they can still detect sound. And the way that they can do this is sound is a pressure wave, and it can move through anything like air, water, steel that can compress even a little bit. And when you have that pressure wave moving through, it's essentially mechanical energy. It's moving the particles. And a lot of animals in the ocean, even if they've never evolved an ear, they've still evolved this structure that evolved very, very early in evolution called a hair cell. It's another one of those things that I could probably write another whole book just about the history of hair cells and all their different iterations. But at the end of the day, it's actually quite simple. You've got a cell. It's got a little protrusion that we call a hair, and it's got an attached neuron or a nerve. And when that hair is bent or twinged or pushed, then the nerve fires, and that's it. And so these hair cells are very, very, very common in tons of different animals. And what they're often used for is detecting, as you can imagine, touch or any sort of wave or whatever. But whenever you have the opportunity to bend a hair, you have the opportunity to perceive something. And what we find is that a lot of these animals have an organ that detects gravity and orientation. This is very important for pretty much every animal. It needs to know which way it's facing. And animals that detect gravity, they do it with something called a statocyst. And a statocyst is essentially a chamber lined with hair cells. And inside of this chamber is a dense stone or a little rock. And sometimes these animals can use a grain of sand or they'll accrete it themselves. But however it comes to be in whatever animal you're talking about, a squid, a scallop, a lobster, the statocyst has that same basic principle. And as the animal tilts and moves and faces this way or that, the mass inside kind of rolls around. Like if you have a suitcase in your car and you take a curve too quickly, it throws up against the wall. And as it moves around, it bumps into those hair cells inside, bends them, and fires a nerve. And that's how the animal knows what way it's facing. But what we find underwater is that this same structure is also capable of detecting sound. And the way that that happens is because as the sound moves through the water and through the animal's body, it creates tiny, tiny little vibrations and tiny, tiny pressure waves as they're moving through. And because that stone is heavier, it doesn't move through the stone. And it creates this differential, tiny, tiny differential motion between the stone and the hair cells in the statocysts or other organs that are used to tell balance and orientation. And all that does is it transmits the mechanical motion of the sound into an electrical signal to the brain, and it can also detect a sound. And so what we find with animals like squid or crabs or shellfish is that wherever they have these statocysts, if you have sounds, especially low or loud sounds, they're perfectly capable of detecting those as well. So that's the short answer to how animals that don't have ears can still tap into sound underwater.
So animals can hear sound, as you have so eloquently described, but also animals under the water can make sounds. Now, we've always known, for a while at any rate, that whales can, and whales can sing, and Frank Wattington in 1955 began to detect this, and Roger Payne took over from him, and Roger Payne gave his recordings to Judy Collins, and we had that lovely whale song. Clicks are produced by dolphins, by toothed whales, and we know about them. But apparently, according to your book, it turns out that lots of fish can actually make sounds. And furthermore, a lot of them have been auditioned so that their sounds are recorded and filed. Now, how could you find out that a fish made a sound? And how in the name of goodness do you audition a fish so that you know which fish is making the sound to put into your sound file? That is the most amazing part of your book. Have you ever auditioned a fish yourself?
I have auditioned a fish. I specifically tried to audition a fish called a cusk eel in Cape Cod, and unfortunately, the fish did not feel like performing for me that day, but I have auditioned one. But the reason why they did this was exactly what you said. You need to know what animal's making what sound. And in fact, the impetus for this was around about World War II, we developed the technology to listen underwater the way that an animal would be able to hear underwater and hear all the sounds we never knew before. And because it was World War II and there was a war going on, and then a few years later into the Cold War, the problem became that there were these military hydrophones underwater that were trying to detect enemy submarines, because submarine warfare was just as much a part of these wars as was air or land wars. And so military sonar operators needed some sort of manual or some sort of guide to know what was an enemy and what was just natural underwater sound. But because we'd never listened before, we didn't really know. So if you heard a blip, blip, you didn't know if it was a whale or if you didn't know if it was another submarine. So the first auditions and the first real efforts to catalog these sounds was done by the military to try to figure out what wasn't an enemy. And to audition fish, they actually funded a woman called Marie Poland Fish. Her last name was actually Fish. And she drove up and down the coast. And what she would do is she would get a fish, any species of fish in the ocean. She would put it in a tank, or she would put it in a tide pool. And she would essentially put a hydrophone in the water with it and then poke it or prod it or you know, hold it and see if it made a noise. And then she would record what that noise was. And then she would put it in the guide. And so essentially what they did was they built up these sort of field guides, or like an Audubon Society thing, just of sounds underwater and biologicals, they called them, just so that they would know for safety purposes what was and wasn't an enemy submarine. And so these catalogs of fish sounds were put together sort of audition by audition by audition by these scientists who were trying to figure out what made what sound in the ocean. And even to this day, we've only auditioned well under half of the species in the ocean. So we know that many fish do make noise, but we're still learning which ones make what noise and when and why and what time of year and what time of day. Because, you know, fish are going to make noise for different reasons. And sometimes you can listen for months during the winter and hear nothing, and then come back in the spring and you'll hear a whole chorus. So we're still learning a lot about fish noise.
You have a wonderful example in your book about a fish I never heard of. I didn't even think it was a fish's name. It's a plain fin midship man. And apparently the sound of these at a certain time of year can be heard from the land without any hydrophones at all. And they're doing this particular sound for a very specific reason, because why do fish make the sounds? But you seem to have a handle on what the plain fin midshipman is doing. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, this is a fish that lives on the coast of British Columbia and down into the US, where I live in Victoria in Canada. And every spring, this little fish, it's probably about the size of a paperback book. It's maybe 8 or 10 inches long. And they're funny little things. They have big triangular heads and tiny little bodies, and you wouldn't think much to look at them. But every spring, when they want to find a mate and continue the species as they do, the males will swim up towards the tide line right on the shore, and they'll find a big rock and they'll make a nest under the rock. And then what they'll do is they'll bulk up these special muscles in their bellies. And these muscles are kind of wrapped around their swim bladder, which is an air-filled sac that helps them control their buoyancy. And when the males get all bulked up, they'll start to vibrate this muscle against the swim bladder like a drum, like a hand on a drum. And it just creates this incredibly loud droning noise. And where you get whole herds of midshipmen, I guess, up on the shore, people who live in houseboats or people who live beside the water there, they can actually start to hear these fish through the hulls of their boats, and sometimes even if they're just standing on the shore. And what it is the male is trying to send out the loudest, most furthest carrying sound that he can to attract a female. And the females will, their hearing sensitivity actually changes at this time of year. This is in May or June. And they'll tap into this male's humming noise, and they'll come up and they'll find the biggest, loudest male. And that's where they'll deposit their eggs with him. And the reason is because in fish, where there's parental care, the midshipman is actually the one who makes the nest and then takes care of the eggs and the babies until they're ready to leave. And so the female wants to find the biggest, strongest male because he's the one who's going to be able to sit there and guard the eggs for the longest. And so it's essentially a love song. But I have to say that to my human ears, it doesn't sound all that entrancing. But when you actually know what's going on, it's quite something.
Absolutely, indeed. Now, I want to move you on now to talk about the kind of sounds under the sea. I mean, there's what you're calling biophony, which are the sounds made by the living things that we're talking about now. There's geophony, which is the sounds made by the waves, by the volcanoes, by the earthquakes. These are sounds that are going to be there regardless of humans. And then there's the anthropophony, which are the sounds made by us. And one of those is sonar. And sonar is echo sounding off the seabed. You send down a sound, it's reflected off the seabed and it comes back. And this was how did they used for depth sounding, how long it took to come back, where the bottom was there rocks, was there icebergs nearby, all of this sonar. But it actually turns out that this was already being carried out by first of all, they detected it in the bats who send out their echolocation. But that echolocation is also carried out by whales and by the toothed whales, that they are able to make a sound and then they're able to interpret when it comes back. So this is an amazing thing. They make the sounds, they listen to the echoes, and this is what all these clicks are about that we come hear from dolphins, we hear from orcas, we hear from the belugas, from the toothed whales in general. And it's a way of detecting and catching prey, a way of knowing where the other ones are, like a communication system essentially between one and another.
Yeah, it's interesting because around about 1900, there was this incredible advance in science above the waves where people were starting to really understand that bats, as you said, were using echolocation to find their way around in the dark. And this had been a problem for centuries and people were just starting to figure it out. And then in 1912, when the Titanic sank, there was a real call for some way that scientists could use to help ships detect icebergs from a distance. And there was all these inventions and all these inventors, including, you know, Sir Hiram Maxim, who was originally invented the machine gun, who put in a patent for a way of using the same echo sounding that bats use to detect icebergs. So there was this real confluence of energy trying to figure out how you could sort of tell things at a distance using sound. And it was actually Reginald Fessenden was one of the key people who patented a underwater iceberg sounder that could send out sound signals underwater and bounce it off an iceberg and then tell how far away the iceberg was from a distance, which would increase the safety in the North Atlantic. And that was sort of the start of humans starting to use sonar underwater. But then what we discovered was that animals, and specifically, as you said, the toothed whales, have been doing that for millennia. And they make these very, very loud click noises. And they send out the click and then they listen to the echo of the click. And first of all, the time between the click and the echo tells them how far away the thing is. So right away, you can tell distance. And then if the sound is compressed or stretched out when it returns, you can tell if the thing is moving towards you or away from you. So it's like a Doppler shift in the click. They can interpret that too. And they can tell whether the thing is moving fast or slow, or if it's over here, or over there. And they can even, because the click sound can kind of penetrate into the animal or the thing that they're sounding, they can even maybe tell what material it is. And there's been studies done on dolphins and belugas that they can actually tell the material of a target. They can tell if it's metal or copper or wood because their clicks can tell them that level of detail of information. So the sophistication of these whales' ability to use echolocation is still unmatched by naval sonar. They still have abilities that we can barely dream of, but it's really incredible what they can do. And that's how they find food and they find prey. And that's how they tell if there's, you know, where the bottom is or if the water is really dark and murky, you know, where other animals are. It's incredible.
You'd wonder then how they get lost or how they get beached and things. But we're continuing as humans to make more and more noises in the sea. We make lots and lots of sonar sound, which damages the animals if it gets too close to these really loud sounds. It causes them distress. We make seismic shocks, which is a way of exploring to see whether there's any underwater minerals or gas or oil or these things by sending out seismic shocks that explode and come back with a different sound. Our ships are making sounds, the engines, the propellers, our wind turbines when we're pile driving to put those down into the bottom of the sea. All of these human sounds coming in on top of the wonderful hearing apparatus of the creatures under the water. Are we, by making all these awful sounds, causing a huge disruption to the underwater life in our oceans?
Yeah, one of the things that I kind of drove me to work on the book in the first place was because when I would read about threats or problems in the ocean, I'd read about, you know, oil spills or microplastics, and I could picture it very easily. So I understood it. But whenever somebody said, oh, underwater sound could hurt animals, I had this kind of blip in my understanding. I couldn't quite picture how that worked. And so that curiosity to understand it better was part of why I started working on the book. Because in my mind, as you said, a sound, if it's very, very, very loud, might injure an animal, you know, it might hurt its ears. But beyond that, I just couldn't quite understand how a sound could be that bad. But the more I started to learn about how much animals rely on sound to do things underwater, the more I realized that you don't even have to be that close to an animal or have that loud of a sound. As long as your sound disrupts it or distracts it or changes its behavior, it can have a real impact on the animal's survival. Like the more that you do with sound, the more you can mess with that survival by messing with the sound. So if you have a fish that relies on sound to find a mate, or if you have a whale that relies on sound to keep in touch with its baby, or you have a coral that relies on sound to find a reef to settle, well, the more you understand just how extensive that reliance is, then the more you see, oh, it doesn't take that much. It just takes a sound that can maybe mask this or distract or chase an animal away. And then you have these effects that can be really profound underwater. And that's kind of what I discovered as I was going through. The more that you do with sound, the more you stand to lose when you can't hear anything.
Yeah, you had a very horrifying remark in your book that I was very taken aback by, because you would think surely humans aren't everywhere, but you said in the deepest ocean trench down at the bottom, putting a microphone or a hydrophone down there, we can actually hear man-made sounds at the bottom of the deepest ocean trench. Isn't that terrible?
Well, it's something else. And that's because that's shipping noise, actually, because shipping is... You know, I talked to a lot of different scientists for this book, and I asked them all, you know, what's the biggest challenge? What's the biggest problem? Not because, you know, there's not more than one problem, but just because, you know, where can we start? And they all said, you know, there's a lot of sounds that humans make in the ocean, a lot of noise that we make. But the one that is constant and the biggest thing everywhere is just shipping. And that's because so much of our industry and our commerce is moved by the ocean. And we humans don't really see that because we don't usually spend a lot of time in ports or out in the open ocean. We just don't see how much. But you know, the amount of shipping in the ocean, the amount of noise in the ocean from shipping doubled every decade from 1960 through to the early 2000s. The size of container ships has increased immensely. Even during the coronavirus, when everything kind of shut down in 2020, if you look at, as I did, if you look at the number of containers through the ports on the West Coast, you saw this little tiny dip of about 10 or 20%. For the first few months of the pandemic when everything shut down. And then you saw the rebound to record levels by the end of 2020, just because everyone started buying everything online. And all that stuff is moved by the ocean. And so you have these shipping lanes that have huge vessels going 24/7, and they don't have to be deafening to have an impact. They're just constant. And you can't really go anywhere in the ocean that that noise doesn't carry, because remember, underwater sound carries so much further and works so well that when you make a noise in the ocean, it can travel hundreds, in some cases, even thousands of kilometers, and it just ricochets around the ocean basins.
Yeah, you were saying the quietest part of the oceans at the moment is the Arctic, where under the ice, where there isn't shipping, and that you're recommending in your last chapter, How to Quiet an Ocean, that record should be kept of the quietness there. So we will have a baseline to match up with when the ice finally all melts and they're going from the Atlantic to the Pacific through the Northwest Passage, bringing shipping through places which were quiet before. That's not very hopeful or positive to say. We'll record the quiet so we know what it was like when it was gone.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where I'd like to say, well, it would be nice if we could keep everything the way it is. And the Arctic, you know, it's definitely got a lot of sound in it. The ice makes a ton of sound. Icebergs make a huge amount of sound. But these are sounds that animals evolved and grew up in and evolved in, and they understand sort of what that soundscape is like. And as you say, climate change is making it so that the ice at the polar at the North Pole is retreating, and more you're going to have open water with wind and wave noise that instead of ice noise. The whole soundscape is going to change. Species are already moving north. Killer whales are moving into the Arctic Ocean at different times of year. And killer whales, as you know, are not only predatory, but they make their own noise. So they're changing the soundscape. Even the prey species of little zooplankton are moving up into the Arctic Ocean. The species are changing. Cod, Atlantic cod are moving north. Polar and Arctic cod are being pushed further north. So even before you get to shipping and industry, you have this massive change in the soundscape just caused by the fact that as soon as you take the ice off the Arctic Ocean, you completely change who's there and what they're doing and what they're trying to hear or say. And then you add into that not only, as you said, the Northwest Passage, but also just exploitation of minerals and mining in the Canadian Arctic, which is what I was looking at specifically. You'll have supply ships and you'll have, industry coming in and going out. So it would be nice to say, well, let's just not do that. Let's try to keep it the way it is. But if we're going to have things up there and we're going to have people moving in, we do have a little bit of a window here where if we can figure out what the baseline soundscape is now, and we know where key areas are that maybe are, you know, whale breeding grounds or where key fish aggregations, if we're going to have shipping lanes, maybe we can try to situate them in relationship to marine protected areas in such a way that we minimize our impact. It's a bit of a bittersweet hope, as you can hear from me talking about it. But if we are going to do things, at least in the Arctic, we do have potentially the chance to try to not be quite so clumsy and bumbling with where we've put things and how we run about things and what we've done in the temperate ocean.
Anyway, Amarina, it's been great talking to you. The book is fantastic. It's called Sing Like Fish, How Sound Rules Life Underwater. It's published by Scribe, and I'm sure it's available in all good bookshops everywhere. My one says it's £16.99 sterling, so I'm sure that's what it is. So if anyone is interested in any aspect of sound in the ocean, this is a book that they should really pick up. Now I understand when I was diving in the Red Sea how I could hear a pile driving in Aqaba, which seemed to be miles and miles away. The sounds, of course, carried much faster and better underwater. You couldn't hear anything when you came up, but under the water you could hear this bang, bang, bang of the pile driving kilometres, hundreds of kilometres away in Aqaba. So thank you very much for being so erudite and explaining it all so well to me. It was wonderful talking to you, Amarina. Thank you very much.
Goodbye, Anna. Thank you so much.
Goodbye, Amarina. It was great talking to you, and I hope you see more loons now when you go back out again.
Oh, well, I got to tell you, there's a loon family that lives in our bay, and there's a mother and a father and a baby. And they do a patrol along the shoreline every day. They go three times a day along. And when you sit here long enough to see them, you start to see their habits. So I just saw them doing their lunch patrol, and I'm sure they'll set out on their evening patrol in about 3 hours.
Well, you keep an eye out for them anyway. Goodbye now, and thank you for talking to me.
Absolutely wonderful. What a great listen. And if that interview does not inspire you to run into your local bookshop and pick up a copy of that book, then nothing will. That's pretty much all we have time for tonight. Thanks to everybody who worked on today's programme. Until next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Email mooney@rte.ie.